Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to Pod on the Tyne, The Athletic's dedicated Newcastle United podcast. My name's Taylor Payne and it's an absolute joy to be back with Chris Woff and George Cock. And Chris Woff, how the devil are you? I've heard you've been in trouble with the law this week, is that right?
Well, there's been some wild accusations being thrown around, and I don't just mean by George Culkin on the previous podcast. Yes, well, I'll let you explain, because if people haven't seen this on social media, then really this is a sort of
they really need to.
Yeah. So go on then, explain yourself.
So there was a tweet from Kent Police where they put an e-fit of a man who was being... They were trying to locate a man who had committed a robbery or a burglary of some kind. And Chris, I mean, it really, really did look like you, didn't it? It really did.
I mean, I'm not really at liberty to say that's probably more for George to comment on.
Well, no, it does. It looks, it's identikit. It's got the same pudding bowl haircut.
The Lego hair, yeah.
It's just a man, you know, looking guilty. I mean, the thing is, though, Chris does have, of course, have the ultimate alibi, which he never, ever goes south of Low Fell. So
that's very true.
Whatever this fella's been accused of, it couldn't be Chris, could it?
I mean, if we find out that he robbed a butcher's, then, you know, then we...
True.
Things might have
a large
changed.
Quantity of sausages have gone missing. Could be him.
Apart from that, Chris, apart from being on the lam, are you all right?
Yes, I'm fine, thank you. I was going to say I'm looking forward to going to Burnley, which I don't know if I've ever said before, but I am actually looking forward to going across the Pennines on the weekend to see Newcastle play at Burnley.
How strange.
It's not a bad little jaunt, that. It's not a bad little jaunt. How's George Corgan? Are you all right?
Yeah, I'm okay. Yeah, I've just seen also on social media that Lewis Miley has had a tattoo, a sort of Newcastle tattoo to celebrate his 18th birthday, which is quite something. Coincidentally, I've also just had a tattoo, and it's of a on my... Oh. You almost certainly can't use that. So I just thought I'd do
no,
that.
No, let's definitely not use that. Let's...
Right. So forget that. Yeah, I'm totally fine, Taylor. Thank you for asking. How are you?
I'm not bad. Have you got anything to say about Lewis Miley's tattoo, George?
No, it's a beautiful piece of art. Body art. Lovely.
Yeah. Anything to say about it, Chris?
I wouldn't necessarily describe it as a beautiful piece of body art, but I'm not going to say any more than that.
Chris, a man who seems to spend most of his time shoving offal into whatever orifices he can cram it into, is now seems to be of the belief that a body is a temple. It's quite strange.
Yes, that is very strange indeed. Let's move on. Let's do a quick news roundup because there's been some bits and bobs happening this week. The Premier League vote on a spending cap. Chris, what measures are being considered here?
Right, so this is quite complicated, so I'm going to try and give the
sort of... You are the man
of,
for the job. Come
well,
on.
Yes, I'm going to give the sort of diluted version of this. But essentially, the Premier League have voted to take a vote on something, which, despite the way that maybe some people have taken it, it is not going to completely replace PSR rules. PSR rules, as we've already discussed, look like they are going to be changed and reformed going into the 2025-26 season, and they will become a sort of a squad cost control ratio to revenue rather than they are at the minute, which is £105 million you can lose over three rolling years. Now, this spending cap, it's called anchoring. It's something which is basically being imported in from a lot of US sports. And essentially what it will mean is that no club can spend more than a certain multiple of the bottom club in the Premier League, whatever they earn from the Premier League's TV rights, which is around about £100 million at the minute. Now, the multiples being discussed are sort of 4.5 or 5. So in theory, if it is £100 million, no club could, in terms of on wages, amortised transfer fees and also agent fees, could spend more than 5 times £100 million, so £500 million in each year. Now, in theory, that sounds like Newcastle could then go and spend more money, but this is on top of the PSR rules that are already in place.
Yeah.
And so Newcastle would still have to, within their own revenue, only be able to spend, with the Premier League's proposed rules, 85%, but if they're in European competition, 70%. So this is basically to try and rein in the very top spenders in the Premier League and stop them from being able to spend massive multiples compared to everyone else. So longer term, if Newcastle's revenues grow massively, it might curb them, but it isn't going to suddenly allow Newcastle to go and spend several hundred million pounds over the course of the next few windows and have no PSR recompense.
And Newcastle voted in favour of this particular vote. So why is that?
Well, I think because in the short to medium term, it doesn't stop them from being able to grow their revenues and it doesn't allow them to spend any more money. But what it maybe does is it maybe stops someone like Man City or Chelsea or one of the other really big clubs who spend a lot of money and have bigger revenues from being able to spend a heck of a lot more and getting even further ahead of Newcastle. And it's sort of, the theory is, it doesn't level the playing field because they're still going to be able to spend far more if you've got more higher revenue. And obviously longer term, Newcastle believe they will enter that sphere, but it maybe just curbs that spending slightly. Now the context is, I think when the Premier League clubs were shown the model of this, depending on the different multiples, I think if it was 4.5 times, the only club who would have spent over that over the course of the last few years would have been Chelsea. If it was 5 times, none of the clubs would actually have met that criteria for now. But it means that it shackles future spending. And from a Newcastle point of view, if they stop clubs from spending a heck of a lot more, hopefully the gap, which is still there, they can maybe bridge in a slightly shorter time frame than they come right now.
And there's also been some chat this week, George, about stadium and stadium expansion. But another story that's not quite a story just yet, is it?
Well, yes and no. So obviously the stadium is a story. It's a big story. It's important to lots of people because it's so difficult to get into St James's now. So there's huge demand for tickets and season tickets. And so it's something that everybody cares about a lot. The club have been doing a feasibility study into what might or could happen next, looking at all the options on the table. The understanding now is that the feasibility study has been completed and that Newcastle will be remaining on their current site. That's, you know, that is interesting. The club insists that no final decision has been taken and there's a huge amount of work still to be done before anything else could happen. I mean, it's not a surprise in the sense that if you go back to, you know, pretty much straight after the takeover, when I spoke to Amanda Staveley and Mirdad Gadousi, they said they won't build a new stadium. It would be like tearing your soul out, Gadousi said. Darren Eales, Eddie Howe have all spoken about wanting to stay where they are, if at all possible. And whilst that is the first choice, the preferred option, there is still quite a lot of work to be done before that can become a possibility. There's a lease on the land at St James's Park that would need to be extended. There are the obvious issues that there have been around the East Stand, Leasers Terrace, the area that has always been impossible for the club to expand over. And those issues haven't been solved yet. And of course, you know, then, after all of that, the button has then got to be pressed on what would be a huge investment by the club. So it's good news that there's movement. We are a long way away from anything actually happening on that front, though.
Fair play. Chris, you've been writing about, or you are writing about, Sporting Director as well, and we understand interviews will be happening very soon for that role.
Yes, well, some of those interviews have been taking place this week. I mean, more sort of scheduled in, and the idea is, I think that ideally Newcastle would like to have identified a candidate in the course of the next few weeks, possibly months, but certainly heading into the summer window. I mean, obviously the complication there is, just as Manchester United are finding with Newcastle and Dan Ashworth, that if someone is under contract, there may be a gardening leave period of time that they need to be negotiated. There may be negotiations with the clubs themselves. One of the candidates who we know is Crystal Palace's sporting director, Dougie Friedman, but he's not the only one. We're at the final stages of it, though. And so I've been writing about basically the main issues on the in-tree for any sporting director who's coming in, because really there has been, vacuum might be too strong a word, but there's certainly been a void which has been left in place without the sporting director there in terms of what exactly is happening with certain issues. And we've already spoken about it with PSR, the profitability and sustainability rules of the Premier League. Newcastle obviously have to comply with those. What is the best way to do that? And really, the sporting director should be the person who, from a footballing point of view, when it comes to potentially selling players, whether that is, you decide whether it's going to be one of your sort of prized assets, which Eddie Howe does not want to lose in Alexander Isak or Bruno Guimaraes, or do you then bring in money from player sales of more fringe players or other players in the first team who maybe are viewed as more dispensable? But really, you need a sporting director being the person overlooking all of that and deciding longer term what is to happen. I mean, prime example of this may be Callum Wilson, for example, because Eddie Howe has basically said publicly that ideally he would like to keep Callum Wilson, but there is a decision to be made this summer from a financial point of view for Newcastle, who have to become better sellers and have to find a way to generate more funds going forward. That Callum Wilson's 32 years of age. We all know about his injury record. He also is going into the final year of his deal. This might be the last summer Newcastle could actually theoretically get a decent amount of money for him. Now, it's going to cost a lot of money to bring in a striker of any sort of equivalent goal-scoring potential, but for the longer term benefit of the club, what is the best solution this summer? And really, you want a sporting director in consultation with the head coach, but really someone taking a more overarching long term view of things to be involved in these decisions. And Newcastle don't have that yet at this stage. That's just one of the issues that PSR have discussed. Recruitment in general, is the new person going to be more of a recruitment specialist than Dan Ashworth was, because you have different forms of sporting directors, some more of whom really are more about like a transfer guru, for want of a better term. And then also Eddie Howe's situation in terms of the England job may come up this summer, and the identity of the team going forward. Are the players going to be recruited basically because whoever may succeed Eddie Howe, not that I'm saying he's going anywhere, but you have to have an idea that at some point he may move on. Are the players there for the sort of longer term? Then you've also got the academy and changes that Dan Ashworth's already brought in there, crucial for issues like that. So really, the sporting director is an absolutely vital person for shaping the entire sporting vision of the football club, and that is something which Newcastle are trying to find the best candidate going forward, not just someone who's going to be there for 20 months, as Dan Ashworth proved to be, but someone who hopefully is there for the long term for the club.
Well, that's all we've got time for on Pod on the Tyne.
Yes, thanks for joining us. That was quite the monologue there, Chris. But that's all the information we need, I presume. You would imagine it would be a more difficult summer going through it with everything that's going to be happening without a sporting director. So I'm sure Newcastle are very keen to get somebody in place as soon as possible. Lots of news stories there that with nothing confirmed and no concrete news that we can offer you. One thing that has been confirmed, though, George, is the Premier League will not get 5 Champions League places next season. Also means that Newcastle need to finish 6th to get a Europa League spot, just making things that little bit more complicated.
Well, or does it make it more simple?
It doesn't make it simpler, yeah.
Well, just to offer a counterpoint to Chris's previously exhaustive answer, yes, Taylor, you are correct. Let's move on. And here's John with the weather.
Thank you very much. We'll be back in just a moment with
just
some
more
stories.
Just to be a pain on the backside as well, it doesn't mean that 6th place does not yet guarantee Europa League football.
Oh, right.
Well, it depends on who wins the FA Cup. It needs Man City to win the FA Cup. Because if Man United win the FA Cup and finish 7th, then Newcastle could get the Europa Conference League instead. So it's more complicated than that. But yeah,
so it is more complicated than what we said.
Yeah.
Well, this is certainly becoming more complicated by the by the second, isn't it?
Yeah. I've got a feeling that we make this more complicated, don't we? It doesn't need to be this complicated, but we make it so.
And just before you go to the break, Taylor, just one more quick thing to update you on. Today, there has been released from the Football Association the verdict from the Independent Commission into Sandro Tonali's betting breaches, which he conducted during his time in the UK, so after he arrived, so between August and October, different to the 10-month suspension that he received from the Italian FA, which was primarily for his time in Italy. And it's good news in the sense that Tonali's suspension is not going to go beyond August the 27th as it currently stands in, as long as he does not bet between now and then. He has received a 2-month suspended ban, which runs until the end of the 2024-25 season, plus a £20,000 fine. And basically, the panel heard from mitigation from Sandro Tonali's side, which tried to argue that it would be double punishment if he received a further suspension, a sporting sanction. They actually felt he shouldn't have received even a suspended one, and that they talked about the fact that he has taken a reduced wage during his time at Newcastle since he received the Italian suspension. But on the FA side, they said, despite there being mitigating circumstances, they still felt that this was such a serious potential issue in terms of the integrity of the sport that they believed that a sporting sanction was necessary. The panel heard from both sides and came down basically in between, and they reached the verdict that they did. And so for Tonali and for Newcastle, they have closure in the sense that as long as he is not found to have committed any of their offences between now and the end of August, he will be able to feature for Newcastle United early in the 2024-25 season. And that is a positive. That is what Newcastle hoped and expected the verdict would be. But it's nice now to finally have closure on that front.
Absolutely. Right then, let's have a quick break and we'll be back in a moment.
I will love it if we beat them. Love it.
So, Eddie's Mags go to Lancashire on Saturday and they're looking to turn around that Roby away form. Newcastle away and Burnley at home, both deeply sketchy records. Something's got to give, Chris, hasn't it?
Or it could be a draw, but yes. I'm just being factually accurate, but
fifth place, can get you. Yeah, okay.
But yes, I mean Newcastle, as George has said, have only the 15th best away form in the Premier League. That's really why they aren't actually in the conversation for Champions League football again this season. And despite their home form being excellent, it was their away form last season which got them into those top four positions. And going forward, I mean, Eddie Howe actually spoke about it a little bit last week and said that it's not really acceptable the away form the way it's been, and that there are quite a few issues to address, and he needs to try and work out what those are and how Newcastle can try and resolve that going forward. Is it about identity? Can they replicate what they do at home, away from home, on a consistent basis, particularly when they've got European football to contend with? Or do they need to find a different way? They need to retain possession better. They obviously need to concede fewer goals. And I think far too often when they've gone away from home, it's not only that they haven't performed. I don't think the really big players who turned it on to St. James's have performed either. And that's not digging them out. It's just maybe that's again reflective of maybe fatigue and the like. But Anthony Gordon's record at St. James's Park across this season is phenomenal. But away from home, the numbers just do not stack up. And it's the same for Newcastle United in general. So Burnley, though, have struggled at Turf Moor. They've also conceded some very sloppy goals. I mean, there was the one the other week where the keeper just let the ball go underneath them and conceded the own goal. So I think Newcastle will go there with confidence that they can actually get a positive away result, albeit recently Burnley have been in relatively decent form, have picked up a few important points here and there. But I do think that if there's a ground Newcastle want to go to and believe they can actually address part of the away form, then Turf Moor would be it.
I do agree with Chris, but that decent spell of form encompasses one defeat in their last eight league matches, which is obviously by far their best run of the season. They've beaten Sheffield United, as Newcastle have. They've drawn with Man United. They're in a good run of form, so I don't think this becomes a straightforward match, but they've won two games at home all season. It absolutely has to be a game that Newcastle target for a win if they want to stay where they are or even overhaul Manchester United ahead of them. We know that Newcastle's away form has been poor all season, but they've got more away games to come. This absolutely has to be one that they go for.
Absolutely. Newcastle have been wildly inconsistent this season, but one thing you can almost certainly expect at Turf Moor is goals, Chris. Goals, goals, bloody goals and more goals. Cue a 0-0 draw.
Well, Newcastle's 34 league matches this season have featured 129 goals, which is an average of 3.79
so
per game,
goals.
Which is the second highest average in Premier League history, I believe.
You can't score 3.79 goals in a game.
As soon as you said that, I knew
that
was
coming. I've told you about this.
I'm going to bring on XG in a second, yeah.
Just round it up to four.
But of those 129 goals that have featured in those games, 74 of them have been scored by Newcastle United themselves. And as things stand, they are on course with four games remaining to be the most prolific Newcastle United side of the Premier League era. Now, they've already equaled the record for a season which features 38 matches in the Premier League, which was set by Sir Bobby Robson's side in 2001-02. They also scored 74. They've gone one ahead of 96-97, Keegan and Dalglish's side. They are actually 8 goals ahead already of the 95-96
wow.
side who just...
I mean, that's a surprising one, isn't it? Because you would have thought that that season was one of the ones where we scored
It is, but
so
actually that's only
goals.
The seventh highest total. And actually, if you include Newcastle's very first Premier League season, which was over the course of 42 matches rather than 38, Newcastle are on course to actually score at a higher rate than they did that season. So Newcastle are averaging 2.18 goals per match, which is actually the third highest in their entire top flight history, so going back to beyond the Premier League era as well. So this is a Newcastle side who have scored a heck of a lot of goals.
Yeah, so this is something that Chris and I have had a bit of fun with this week. Got a piece up on The Athletic at the moment, and we're comparing the entertainers with the accidental entertainers, which was Chris's very good description of this season's Newcastle team. So we looked at those other seasons. Chris has mentioned some of the stats there. We got Alan from work involved too, because obviously he played in 96, 97, and indeed in that Sir Bobby Robson team too. So we asked him a bit about that. But first of all, we asked him whether he thought this Newcastle team was set up to score goals.
I think we are a team that's designed to score goals. Yeah, I mean, we've been far too open this season. But we have great technical ability in Isak. We have a 6-yard box finisher or a 12-yard box finisher in Wilson when he's fit. And we have pace that teams hate playing against in Gordon, in Barnes. Yeah, and we've got a really creative midfielder in Bruno who can make that killer pass. So, yeah, it's a very good front foot and attacking team, yeah.
So one thing that we have to sort of point out is that there have already been more goals scored in the Premier League in general this season than in any other season, beating the previous record, which was last season. So for whatever reason, we're definitely in an era where more goals are being scored by everybody, not just Newcastle. That's one thing to say. But I don't know whether we should do... Should we do this chronologically? Should we talk about 93, 94 first? Maybe. I mean, I was probably the only person alive.
I mean, that was the second year of me supporting Newcastle United, so that's bullshit for a start, isn't it?
All right, well, go on. Well, why don't you say what you sort of remember, overall themes or memories from that season?
Malcolm Allen not having any front teeth. That's mainly what I remember from that season. Alex Mathey sliding on his arse and scoring against Sheffield Wednesday, I believe.
Yeah, that's a good memory.
Darren Peacock's lustrous locks.
That's good.
Yeah. It's a hazy memory. I was 12.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, I'd come back to the Northeast after college in 92. So I'd had a season ticket, part season ticket for 92-93, and then it was a full season ticket by 93-94. And the momentum that Newcastle carried with them coming up, when, you know, Keegan talked about telling Alex Ferguson we're coming after him, and, you know, they did it. They finished third that season, and it was that beautiful style of play. They were a small team. Peter Beardsley rejoined,
of course,
the club that summer, and, you know, scored a phenomenal amount of goals, him and Andy Cole together, Rob Lee behind, Lee Clark behind, Scott Sellers on the left. They were dainty footballers, is that the right? I mean, you know, they were absolutely deadly in front of goal, but it was small, short, interchanging passing. It was like beautiful, swarming on the other team, and there was, of course, with it, and I'm sure my memory is sort of affected by this. It was surrounded by that incredible buzz and momentum in the city, and it just felt like an incredible place. It felt like
it's
an incredible place
time,
to be.
Wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, and obviously
really
that,
exciting.
Yeah, and that. You know, there's a parallel there with what's happened at Newcastle over the past 2 or 3 years, of course, and, you know, delighted that a new generation has had that sort of same feeling that I had back then. But for me, that 93-94 team is what I measure Newcastle and football and attacking football by, because it was just so absolutely glorious.
Watson for Beardsley. Cole. Watson. And he's gone for a double as well. Steve Watson. Through the Sellers. Flags down. Cox gets one now. Beresford waited. Sellers, another one of those great positions he takes up, and Fox was hurtling in there to knock it away first time.
Let's talk a little bit about Alan from Work and Sir Les Ferdinand as well. Chris, what are your memories of this? You'll not have many memories of Alan and Les. A little bit before your time, maybe?
It is a little bit before my time, so probably most of my memories have been forged watching it back.
Yeah.
Although I do obviously remember watching Alan Shearer in his prime, and that was his first season when he came in and scored. That's when he set the record for the 15 consecutive home matches that he scored in, which is what Alexander Isak is trying to catch up with at the moment. So probably George is probably better. I say this recognising that George doesn't remember anything, but he's probably better to speak about on this one.
No, but I've had to do some research for this piece, so it's okay. So I can talk with a degree of authority. Maybe that's the wrong word. But yeah, I mean, this is a surprise, really, because obviously it's the season before. I mean, if 93-94 was when the sort of entertainers kind of nickname started, 95-96 was the sort of ultimate expression of that team. You know, both incredible for most of that season,
yeah,
top of the table, winning by whatever it was, 12 points, and then being overhauled by Manchester United. It also has that sort of element of drama and, you know, sporting, footballing tragedy to it, glorious failure, that sort of thing. But, you know, incredible team, Les Ferdinand, Ginola and the others. Now, what happened that summer was that Newcastle don't let disappointment fester. They go out. There's a world record fee spent on Alan Shearer, a.k.a. Alan from Work. He comes in and forms, you know, an absolutely devastating partnership with Les Ferdinand. I mean, even I do remember back then people saying, is this going to work? Can they work? Can they play together? Because you're talking about, you know, two number nines effectively, two out-and-out centre-forwards, goal-scorers, and albeit there was a disappointing start to the season, they just gelled and clicked to the point that Alan said that you know, Les was his favourite strike partner in domestic football, in club football. But it was a season of massive upheaval because Keegan left halfway through, Kenny Dalglish comes in, they still managed to finish second, but it's not what I would remember as a sort of favourite season.
No,
because
that's
of that.
It, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, still.
Can you imagine though, George, as well? Sorry to jump in, but can you imagine being a Premier League centre-half and kicking off the game and looking up and seeing Alan Shearer and Les Ferdinand standing there lining up against you?
No, I mean...
You would shit your pants, wouldn't you?
You totally would. And we've spoken to Alan and indeed Les about this season before, about their partnership before, and, you know, they've both spoken about standing in the tunnel before matches, looking at each other and just knowing that they were going to go out and smash teams.
Yeah.
And, you know, that as a player, to have that feeling, to have that level of confidence is just so precious. Anyway, here's Alan from Work talking about that and his partnership with Sir Les.
Well, sure. Not the favourite of the Manchester United fans. Ferdinand, off the bar, and in! It is 3-0 now! And that's the most difficult
hit. I think the partnership had a bit of everything, you know. It had pace, it had strength, it had two players who were really good in the air, two players who could run in behind, two players who were really physical, technically very good, but also playing in a team that was designed to score goals. It's the forward players that we had. I mean, whether it was Beardsley or Gillespie or Ginola or whoever it was, Rob Lee or whoever, we were in a team that played on the front foot and very, very attacking. And when you've got two centre-forwards who love balls into the box, who love the balls fed up to them, then you have to do that, and we had players that could do that, so that's why we both scored goals.
Great vision from Shearer. Beardsley. Oh, and it's another one now. Yes, Shearer, of course.
And that brings us on, Chris, to that Bobby Robson side of 2001-2002, all pace, power and guile. A different type of team to Keegan's entertainers, but entertaining nonetheless.
Yeah, I mean, this was my first season as a season ticket holder, so this is really when George talks about his sort of the team he looks back on, this is the one for me. And that campaign with having Shearer and Bellamy up front, and then Robert and Solana on the wings, Dier, Speed, what a side. And their ability to attack with raw pace was just frightening. And they really could put the frighteners up teams in terms of the way that they just got the ball from one side of the pitch to the other so quickly, and it would just be in the back of the net before you could see it. And that side finished fourth. They were top at Christmas, and their title chance sort of fell away a little bit towards the end. But early on, they really were in contention for it. And you can see why they would sort of feature on this list.
And Robert could be in again. He is. Similar scenario. Laurent Robert had clinched it for Newcastle. A classic counter-attack. Robbie Robertson is all smiles. And the Toonami are on the march in London for a change. A capital conquest at last. Bobby Robson is going to be top of the Premiership, it seems. He is. Newcastle have beaten Arsenal 3-1 on an evening of enthralling entertainment at Highbury.
Probably less defensively savvy than other Newcastle sides, I'd say, maybe. They probably had a sort of weakness to them at the back at times.
Would you say that puts them closest in comparison to the current Newcastle team, or would you suggest it was maybe one of the other two?
No, I think you're probably right. I mean, this Newcastle side has a lot of pace as well, and they have been suspect defensively. I mean, the difference there, and this is what's sort of puzzling again to a certain degree about this present Newcastle side, is that last season they were very, very good defensively.
Yes.
And so that it's sort of there are various and so many myriad factors, really, which we've already discussed as to why Newcastle haven't been the team of last season in 2023.
2020. Oh, a small bird's just flown in the window there. Lovely.
The lesser spotted sausage thrush.
In 2023-24. But I think that yeah, there are a lot of comparisons between those two sides, really, in terms of maybe a bit fallible at the back, but going forward can really cause teams problems, and particularly with the pace going forward and the pace on the, particularly in wide areas as Newcastle have right now as well.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I'm not sure that we sort of draw kind of conclusions from this. I mean, I think it does show that raw goal scoring as a metric isn't necessarily the best one to use to to sort of measure other teams. But it is interesting. I mean, and again, I think this season you look at some of the results. Obviously, they put 13 goals past Sheffield United in two games. There's been a huge amount of high scoring games. But trying to draw themes from this season, apart from, as you said at the start, Taylor, the inconsistency and the bitterness, obviously the injuries, it doesn't feel like it's been that sort of explosive season to me. I guess because a lot of those games have been sort of stressful.
Yeah.
You know, Newcastle have lost games in which they've scored in. There's been that, you know, it hasn't been the pure joy that last season was, where they defended brilliantly, played brilliantly, attacked brilliantly. You knew, kind of knew what you were going to get, but at the same time, it was so fresh into this new era that everything felt like a kind of great surprise. It just hasn't had that feeling to it. It is much more akin, I think, to the 96-97 season, when there was that kind of level of upheaval about the team and you were wondering, for a lot of it, what was going to happen next. But yeah, the accidental entertainers. I think that is the great and right name. Well done to Chris for having that original thought, by the way.
I'm just shocked that George would acknowledge something positive.
I wish I'd thought of that.
Accidental entertainers. It's good. Yeah. No, it is good. I think.
But in terms of that as well, I mean, one of the interesting things that I found when we were sort of looking into the data behind this was that Alexander Isak is Newcastle's top scorer this season with 19 goals in the league, which is 26% of their overall tally. Whereas if you go back into previous seasons, so he's basically accounted for a quarter of Newcastle's goals. They've had 19 different goal scorers this season, as we've already mentioned on previous podcasts. They're on course. They could still do it if Elliot Anderson or Emil Kraft score. They could still join the Man United's record of 20 or even break it. But in previous seasons, so Andy Cole in 93-94... scored 41% of the goals. And then Beardsley, he got 34. Beardsley got 21. So basically the vast majority of the goals came from two players.
Yeah.
Alan Shearer in 96, 97 and 2001, 34% and 31%. So one player contributed a lot more of the goals in those previous seasons than has been the case this year. Newcastle have actually spread the goals around. It isn't that a lot of players have been prolific. Only Anthony Gordon alongside Alexander Isak has actually reached double figures, but a lot of players have contributed sort of 3-4 goals here and there, and that's maybe again where this side differs from those previous teams.
Ultimately, perhaps what Eddie Howe said after the Sheffield United thrashing last weekend is sort of accurate. You know, he was actually asked about overhauling the 95-96 team, which they'd already done. And he said, you know, we want to attack. We want to be known for being an attacking team, a team that's always looking for opportunities to score and to excite our unbelievable supporters and play the style of football that's in keeping with the traditions of the club. But it's all about winning games, and we've probably been too leaky the other way. I think that probably sums it up quite nicely, that yes, attacking and entertaining and scoring goals is very much part of Newcastle's identity, but it's been blurred a fair bit too.
Maybe in 10 years' time, we'll be looking back and talking about Eddie Howe's 22-23 team in the same breaths as the way we do about the Robson team and the Keegan team going by. I think that might be fair to say. How about this, though? A wild card entry 12 years ago to the day since Papa Cisse's incredible brace against Chelsea. How about Pardew's goal-getters, Chris? What do you reckon? Could they be in with a shout?
Well, again, I mean, a team that tacked at pace, that side were able to do that. I mean, Cisse's goals were completely created by himself. Those two were absolute wonder strikes against Chelsea. But if you remember some of the matches, the way that Newcastle counter-attacked through Cisse, Hatem Ben Arfa, Johan Cabaye playing the ball through, that was a very, very good side to watch. And so, yeah, I mean, another side who could attack really well when they wanted to. But again, they were very leaky. I think the goal difference at the end of that season was barely into the positive figures, despite Newcastle finishing in fifth place, which says a lot about that side. And that maybe, again, that at the back was where they struggled, whereas going forward, they really could cause side problems.
Take care. You know what it means. Look after yourself. Okay, good luck.
Right, back to Burnley. Eddie Howe's 100th Premier League game in charge of Newcastle United, George.
Yeah, so happy 100 games. Happy first century, Eddie. Here's to many more. I mean, it's a staging point. It's definitely something to be celebrated. What an astonishing record it's been overall. 99 games so far, 48 wins. I mean, that says everything, really. 168 points, points per match, 1.7. I mean, of course, you can't get
1.7
points for a match, can you? So I should round that up to two, but you can't get 2 points to a match. So I should probably round that up to three. So he's got three points every match, which means he hasn't lost a game, and therefore he's got 300 points so far, according to my logic.
He's only played 99 games so far.
Yeah,
so.
Well, whatever. It does mean I should probably resign, with apologies to everybody who's had to listen to that. I'm sorry.
It's quite a milestone, though, Chris, isn't it? 100 games in charge. Do you think it'll be playing on his mind at all, or do you think he'll not even give it a second's thought?
I don't think he will give it a second's thought, but in terms of, as George says, that sort of staging post, Newcastle in the Premier League table for that, the 99 games as is up to now, during the entire time Howe's there, they've got accrued the sixth highest number of points, and when you consider that they were second bottom of the table and winless when he took over, that is quite the achievement, as we've reiterated so many times before. But also, he's going back to Burnley, a club that he managed previously. And also, it was his first win in charge of Newcastle. So that took him a few games to get going at that point. But then once he had that win, things have snowballed since then. And he's actually only the fourth Newcastle manager in the Premier League era who will reach 100 matches. And he's got the second best points per game ratio and win ratio behind Kevin Keegan's first spell for a Newcastle manager. So that shows how well he's done as well. He's ahead of Robson, he's ahead of Roda, he's ahead of Pardew. So from his 99 games in charge, he's got a 48.5% win percentage. And then, as George mentioned about the points per game. So it's been quite the achievement so far, but he will undoubtedly want to build on that and make sure that there are many more, and that he actually surpasses all those others.
A little bit of a personnel update. Miggy Almiron back in training, but Kieran Trippier has jetted out to Dubai, causing a little bit of a stir online, George.
Well, if that's a reference to the pictures of him training with his shorts like pulled high.
Good Lord, yes.
I mean, that man is 83% thigh, isn't he?
And at least 83.
Isn't the human body made up of like 84% water or something?
Whoa, I don't know. I don't know if that's the case with Chris, but I think for the rest of us, that's
well, no, it's 83% mince in the case of Chris. But like for everybody, how can you be like? I mean, Kieran Trippier is 83% thigh. That man, what an astonishing set of thighs he's got.
He appears to have borrowed his shorts from Gary Lineker in the 1990 World Cup as well. They were right up there, weren't they?
They certainly were.
Right,
yeah.
Up there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good heavens.
But obviously great to see him back on the grass. He said the same thing himself, not too long to wait, words to that effect. So, yeah, huge boost if and when he comes back for the run-in. Great also with Miggy. We'll find out a bit more when we hear from Eddie Howe before the Burnley match. But yeah, one of the sort of great positives of the Sheffield United game was Callum Wilson coming on, Harvey Barnes coming on. Newcastle need more of that.
Do we know if there's anybody else, Chris, who's potentially close to a return? There has been whispers about Joe Linton over the last couple of weeks.
Eddie Howe will speak before the match tomorrow, so we will be even less clear come post that press conference. But I think at this stage, it seems that the only really likely one to be back for Burnley was going to be Miguel Almirón. The rest of them are slightly further behind in terms of their recovery, in the likes of Nick Pope and Joe Linton. So I think that Almirón is the one who would be a boost if he's back in the squad for this weekend. I'm going to disagree slightly with George on the Trippier point, because he said it would be a boost. I actually think it's a bit of a negative that it's taken far longer than really the Newcastle initially thought to be back, because the initial prognosis was he might be back not long after the March international break. Then it was going to be at Crystal Palace, and here we are, and it still looks like he probably won't be back until Brighton next week.
It's not a negative that he's coming back. I mean, the point I was making, it's a boost he's coming back. I know what you're saying, it's taken far too long for him to come back, but it's not a negative that he's coming back. You can't disagree with me.
Fair enough. No, I do disagree with you.
Chris Wolf, turning positives into negatives for the last 30 years nearly. Bless you, mate. Right then, that's it. Thank you very much, chaps. Thank you for your time, Chris.
You're very welcome. I shall speak to you all soon.
Oh, lovely. Thank you very much, George, for your time as well.
You're very welcome. I think I am off to get a tattoo. I'm just sort of doing further research on Lewis Miley's tattoo, which is like, never give up on your dreams, which, I mean, he's 18 years old. He's barely been conscious for like half an hour.
Yeah.
He was a baby about 3 minutes ago. Never give up on your dreams. How long has he had these dreams? He got into Newcastle United's first team at the age of 3 years and 6 months.
Yeah, that's it.
I'm going to get a tattoo that just says, no, do give up on your dreams. Life is essentially futile. You're born, you keep your head down, then you die, if you're lucky. Admittedly, I'm going to have to get an arm extension before I can get that tattoo on my arm, but that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah, as a 42-year-old man who's never really had a proper job, I'm going to get, isn't it about time you gave up on your dreams? That's what I think I'll have. Yeah. Right then. Okay, that's it. Thank you very much for listening. Get in touch at Pod on the Tyne on Twitter or X. Email us at podonthetyne@theathletic.com. We will speak to you next week. Have a good weekend. Take care of yourselves from everybody at Pod on the Tyne. Goodbye.
The Athletic.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18+. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Eastern and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.